Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a follow-up on Mayor de Blasio's remarks on this program about taking Donald Trump seriously.
I don't think anyone should take Donald Trump lightly. I think when I say this particularly as a progressive, when you take conservatives lightly, you end up getting burned a lot of the time.
We'll replay the mayor's full answer to my question about the progressive response to Trump and your answers to the question, what would Trump's deportation and end to birthright citizenship policies mean for New York, our city of 3 million immigrants? But let's begin with another story from the presidential race, Hillary Clinton's extended dialogue recorded on video with members of Black Lives Matter. We'll play two extended excerpts in just a minute and then open the phones, especially for any of you who feel very identified with the Black Lives Matter movement, to respond to the dialogue we're about to play and to say what you think the movement should do next. You know, like, should it be more of an Occupy Wall Street style movement where you put the big idea out there in public and hope it changes hearts and minds like Occupy did with inequality, or more of a Tea Party style movement, not on the issues, obviously, but which got a specific policy agenda out there and has been pushing it ever since to the forefront of Republican politics, including in Congress. So anyone who feels identified with Black Lives Matter and wants to discuss the possible policy agenda you would want to use as, let's say, a test of presidential candidates' seriousness, or to say if it's bigger than that, deeper than that, and that's not the immediate point, or anything else related, 212-433-WNYC. But first, we're going to listen to some extended excerpts of Hillary Clinton and two Black Lives Matter activists. But if you want to call in and get in line, you can. 212-433-9692. Here are two clips from the video. This first one, or they were both, recorded on August 11th after a Clinton campaign event in New Hampshire. As the New York Times reports the context, activists tried unsuccessfully to disrupt the event. Mrs. Clinton agreed to speak privately with the group's representatives, and that happened. The full video of the discussion was only released on Wednesday, so this is about our first opportunity to bring you part of it. This first excerpt begins with activist Anasia Yancey for about 3.5 minutes of a back and forth, taking it to Clinton about some of her and her husband's past policies.
You and your family have been personally and politically responsible for policies that have caused health and human services disasters in impoverished communities of color through the domestic and international war on drugs that you championed as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State. And so I just want to know how you feel about your role in that violence and how you plan to reverse it.
Well, you know, I feel strongly, which is why I had this town hall today, and is, you know, the questions and the comments from people illustrated, there's a lot of concern that we need to rethink and redo what we did in response to a different set of problems. And, you know, in life, in politics, in government, you name it, you got to constantly be asking yourself, is this working, is it not? And if it's not, what do we do better? And that's what I'm trying to do now on drugs, on mass incarceration, on police behavior and criminal justice reform, because I do think that there was a different set of concerns back in the 80s and the early 90s, and now I believe we have to look at the world as it is today and try to figure out what will work now, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. That's what I intend to do as president.
Yeah, and I would offer that it didn't work then either, and that those policies were actually extensions of white supremacist violence against communities of color. And so I just think I want to hear a little bit about that, about the fact that actually while those policies were being enacted, they were ripping apart families and actually causing death.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you. I'm not sure I disagree that any kind of government action often has consequences. And certainly the war on drugs, which, you know, started back in the 80s, right? Has had consequences. Increasing penalties for crime and three strikes and you're out and all of those kinds of actions have had consequences. But it's important to remember, and I certainly remember, that you know, there was a very serious, crime wave that was impacting primarily communities of color and poor people. And part of it was that there was just not enough attention paid. So, you know, you could argue that people who were trying to address that, including my husband when he was president, were responding to the very real concerns of people in the communities themselves.
Right.
Now, I do think that a lot of what was tried and how it was implemented has not produced the kinds of outcomes that any of us would want. But I also believe that there are systemic issues of race and justice that go deeper than any particular law. And part of what we have to do is address the laws. And then we've got to do a much better effort at being honest about the other obstacles and barriers that stand in the way of young people and others having any hope and having any opportunity.
Hillary Clinton with activist Anisha Yancey after a campaign event in New Hampshire last week. And here's another excerpt from that video. This is the part getting the most press. It begins with another activist, Julius Jones, referring to free black labor, slavery, as the first American drug. And then he and Clinton have an exchange of about 8 minutes here on changing hearts and minds and acknowledging white supremacy and anti-blackness and victim blaming versus Clinton's focus on the need for specific action at the policy level. Julius Jones speaks first.
We're in a meeting about drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
America's first drug is free black labor and turning black bodies into profit.
Mm-hmm.
And the mass incarceration system mirrors an awful lot like the prison plantation system.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. It's a similar thread, right? And until someone takes that message and speaks that truth to white people in this country, so that we can actually take on anti-blackness as a founding problem in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that there's going to be a solution because what the conversations that are happening now and why there's so much cohesion across the divide, the red side and the blue side, is because of money. And we spend a lot of money on prisons.
Mm-hmm.
We spend more money on prisons than we are on schools, right? But if we look at it from a lens of let's solve this financial problem and we don't look at the greater bottom line that African Americans who are Americans are suffering at greater rates than most other people, every other people for the length of this country, then it's not going to go away. It's just going to morph into something new and evolve. And I genuinely want to know, you and your family have been in no uncertain way, partially responsible for it. It's more than most, right? Now, there may have been unintended consequences, but now that you understand the consequences, what in your heart has changed that's going to change the direction of this country?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what in you, like, not your platform, not what you're supposed to say. Like, how do you actually feel that's different than you did before? Like, what were the mistakes? And how can those mistakes that you made be lessons for all of America for a moment of reflection on how we treat black people in this country?
I just I apologize. We have.
I would really love to allow her to answer this question.
I'm not stopping.
And we've worked really hard. We've driven so many hours.
We're not stopping. Yeah. I'm just letting you guys know before he is. We've got a couple more minutes. We still have more people in the overflow that are waiting. So I'm not interrupting what you're about to say. I just wanted to sort of give you guys a heads up on timing. So we've got limited time.
Well, obviously, it's a very thoughtful question that deserves a thoughtful answer. And I can only tell you that I feel very committed to and responsible for doing whatever I can. I've spent most of my adult life focused on kids through the Children's Defense Fund and other efforts to try to give kids, particularly poor kids, particularly black kids and Hispanic kids, the same chance to live up to their own God-given potential as any other kid. That's where I've been focused. And I think that there has to be a reckoning. I agree with that. But I also think there has to be some positive vision and plan that you can move people toward. I mean, once you say, you know, this country has still not recovered from its original sin, mm-hmm. which is true, once you say that, then the next question by people who are on the sidelines, which is the vast majority of Americans, the next question is, well, so what do you want me to do about it? What am I supposed to do about it? That's what I'm trying to put together in a way that I can explain it and I can sell it. Because in politics, if you can't explain it and you can't sell it, it stays on the shelf. And this is now a time, a moment in time, just like the civil rights movement or the women's movement or the gay rights movement or a lot of other movements reached a point in time. The people behind that consciousness raising and advocacy, they had a plan ready to go. So that when you turn to, you know, the women's movement, we want to pass this and we want to pass that and we want to do this, problems are not all taken care of, we know that. Obviously, I know more about the civil rights movement in the old days because I had a lot of involvement in working with people. So they had a plan, this piece of legislation, this court case we're going to make, et cetera, et cetera. Same with the gay rights movement. You know, we're sick of homophobia, we're sick of being discriminated against, we want marriage equality, we're starting in the states and we're going to keep going until we get it at the highest court of the land. So all I'm saying is your analysis is totally fair. It's historically fair, it's psychologically fair, it's economically fair. But you're going to have to come together as a movement and say, here's what we want done about it. Because you can get lip service from as many white people as you can pack into Yankee Stadium and mm-hmm. a million more like it, who are going to say, oh, we get it, we get it, we're going to be nicer, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. That's not enough, at least right. in my book. That's not how I see mm-hmm. politics. So the consciousness raising, the advocacy, the passion, the youth of your movement is so critical. But now all I'm suggesting is, even for us sinners, find some common ground on agendas that can make a difference right here and now in people's lives. And that's what I would love to, you know, have your thoughts about, because that's what I'm trying to figure out how to do. So, yeah, deal with mass incarceration. It's not just an economic issue, although I grant you some people see it like that. But it's more than that. I think there is a sense like, you know, low-level offenders, disparity in treatment, we got to do something about that. I think that a lot of the issues about housing and about job opportunities, ban the box, a lot of these things, let's get an agenda that addresses as much of the problem as we can. Because then you can be for something. In addition to getting people to have to admit that they're part of a long history in our country of, you know, either proposing, supporting, condoning, discrimination, segregation, etc. Now, what do we do next? And that's what I'm trying to figure out in my campaign. So that's what I'm doing.
Madam Secretary,
we really have to go.
Thank you.
The piece that's most important, and I stand here in your space, and I say this as respectfully as I can, but if you don't tell black people what we need to do, then we won't tell you all what you need to do.
Well, I'm not telling you. I'm just telling you to tell me.
What I mean to say is that this is and has always been a white problem of violence. It's not, there's not much that we can do to stop the violence against us.
Well, if that is
a conversation that I push back.
Okay, I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Also respectfully.
Yeah. Well, respectfully, if that is your position, then I will talk only to white people about how we are going to deal with the very real problems.
That's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. No. But like what I'm saying is you what you just said mm-hmm. was a form of victim blaming. Right? You were saying that what the Black Lives Matter movement needs to do to change white hearts is
no. I'm not talking about. Look, I don't believe you change hearts. I believe you change laws, you change allocation of resources, you change the way systems operate. You're not going to change every heart. You're not. But at the end of the day, we can do a whole lot to change some hearts and change some systems and create more opportunities for people who deserve to have them to live up to their own God-given potential to live safely without fear of violence in their own communities, to have a decent school, to have a decent house, to have a decent future. So we can do it one of many ways. You know, you can keep the movement going, which you have started, and through it, you may actually change some hearts. But if that's all that happens, we'll be back here in 10 years having the same conversation.
Julia,
because we will not have all of the changes that you deserve to see happen in your lifetime because of your willingness to get out there and talk about this.
Thank you.
Thanks. We've got to go this way.
We should find a way to do this.
Appreciate well, it. Well, I'm ready. Yeah, I'm ready to do my part in any way that I can.
And I'm sure
Hillary Clinton with Black Lives Matter activist Julius Jones after a Clinton campaign event in New Hampshire last week. That video with that audio was just released on Wednesday, a pretty rare unscripted interaction between any leading presidential candidate and a couple of grassroots activists who got themselves in a position to have an extended and videotaped dialogue. So listeners, especially if you feel very identified with Black Lives Matter, call in with your reactions and thoughts on what the movement should do next, in your opinion, kind of reacting to the last bit of that exchange, if you want to, at 212-433-WNYC. Should it be more of an Occupy Wall Street-style movement where you put the big idea out there in public and hope it does change hearts and minds, like Occupy has tried to do with inequality, or more of a Tea Party style movement, which got a specific policy agenda out there and has been pushing it ever since to the forefront of the Republican Congress, or something else? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, we'll talk to Mark Winston Griffith, New York City activist, executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, based mostly in Crown Heights and Bed-Stuy. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you're a policy activist at the local level. Have you thought about what Black Lives Matter might craft as a 5 or 10 point agenda for change for politicians running for office? Or have you thought about how much that's the way to go?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that, yes, I am an activist, but I'm also a journalist. I'm a reporter during other hours, and I've been doing some reporting for The Nation on this, and I've been sort of approaching it as someone who is familiar with the movement from the inside.
Great.
So, you know, as an organization, the Brooklyn Movement Center, we have been part of, I think, what has been the Black Lives Matter movement, although it was not called that, for some time, and have, you know, had a chance to speak to people, went to a conference that was held in Cleveland a few weeks ago, have been talking to thought leaders and people who've been involved and connected with the movement. So, I mean, I think that, one, it's a little bit unfair to frame it as though there have not been policy recommendations up to now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that you go across the country and you see organizations and activists who are connected with this movement, and you see even right here in New York, you know, we've been talking about policies that reform policing, that reform housing, that try to tackle gentrification, that tackle health disparities. And these are policy recommendations that are on the city, state, and federal level that have been recommended for not just years, but of decades. And also, I think you also have to recognize that the policy conversation has shifted since the Black movement, since sort of the Black Lives Matter movement has begun. You know, you see, you know, policing and, you know, just getting to this idea of hearts and minds, I think people's ideas on policing have shifted. You see body cameras now being incorporated. You see here in New York, we passed the Community Safety Act a couple of years ago, and now working on the Right to Know Act, which, you know, which is some serious police reform. So, yes, I mean, in direct answer to your question, I think that this is an evolution. And just as presidential candidate Clinton said that the civil rights movement got to a place where it was, you know, where it was recommending policies, I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, one is an emotional response. It's one that is trying to get people to actually see black lives as being very important, and I think the activist wanted her to talk about that, to talk about her own personal transformation of how she has seen black lives treated. But beyond that, I think that you're going to see policy recommendations that are going to be presented to presidential candidates. I also think it's incumbent upon the presidential candidates themselves to come up with policies. I don't think it's entirely fair for candidate Clinton to throw it back on the activists and say, hey, you have to tell me what these policies should be. You are a policymaker. It's your job to be able to be confronted with a problem and then come up with solutions. And I think that they painted a very graphic picture of what the problem is, particularly the criminalization of black people and the criminal justice system. Once you have that information, then you take that information and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do to make the situation better. In fact, you know, for all the pressure and the tension has been put on Bernie Sanders, he actually recently put together a platform that addresses some of these issues.
Let's take a phone call. Felita in Tenafly, you're on WNYC. Felita, thanks for calling in.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing the view. You know, I am a 40-year-old black woman, single mom, work in corporate America, and I'm privileged enough to afford to send my child to a private school. And, you know, I'm so happy that Hillary Clinton really set it straight with this Black Lives Matter movement. Obviously, Black Lives Matter to me. I'm a black woman. But I never got behind the movement because I personally, as a black woman, never understood what we were fighting for. Was it for the police to stop killing our black children? What are we talking about? And I'm so glad that Hillary Clinton came from behind the veil and said, listen, this is how it works. If you want to see change, let's talk about the areas where we can even the playing field. Let's talk about that so I can actually take something to sell. And this is the reality that the black community, we don't want to hear that it's a sales pitch, but that is the reality. So let's talk about education. Let's talk about why do I have to drive 20 miles away to send my kid to a good private school when I could live in an African-American community and should be able to send her to a good public school.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about why that's not on the table. And I think we're going to need a guide like Hillary Clinton to tell us the other areas where there's inequality, like housing loans, which is also a reason why in some of our black areas where you don't have, you know, good public schools. And, I mean, there's a lot that we don't even know we're being discriminated against. We need someone like Hillary Clinton to give us a handful of topics that we can at least start the dialogue on.
Mark Winston Griffith, do you want to talk to Felita at all, react to that? What are you thinking?
Well, I just think that what is missed there is the extent to which people who are connected with the movement and working with the movement, the extent to which we've been working on policy recommendations and issues for a really long time. And so, you know, to stand in Hillary Clinton's space and to suggest that there are not already policy recommendations on the table, I think is uninformed and a little bit disingenuous. And I think that, you know, when these things pop up, right, and they come into the popular imagination and public fore, I think that what casual observers oftentimes miss is the hard work that has gotten us to this point. Or, you know, that is, the Black Lives Matter movement didn't just sprout up out of nowhere. You know, when I went to Cleveland a few weeks ago to the convening, there were over 1,000 people there of all generational levels who had been doing work for generations, who came and talked about policy, they talked about healing, they talked about a wide range of issues that reflected a body of work that has gone on for a long time. So, you know, I think that maybe perhaps more has to be done to communicate that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more has to be done to sort of package that and consolidate many of these reforms and put them and offer them as a platform. But I think that we have to recognize that many of this conversation has been ongoing for quite a long time.
Oh,
house closed.
Felita, did you want one more say?
Back up.
Hi. No, listen, I understand what he's saying, but as again, as an African-American woman, to not be clear on what the issues are, what can I say? Sometimes you need a person who can speak on behalf of the community to get things done.
Felita, thank you very much. Call us again. Anna in Oak Beach, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Brian. So listen, I really think that, you know, this whole movement started because law enforcement was, for whatever reason, killing young black men. And I think that the movement started because of that. And when you start getting into tangential things like income inequality and all of that stuff, you really have to focus on the issue at hand. You know, law enforcement does not have the proper race relations education that they really need. So I think that they should stick to the one issue.
So that is a pretty narrow lens if you're calling income inequality peripheral or tangential, right?
Well, no, I'm not saying that income inequality is peripheral. I mean, it's the reality of black people in America for a lot of them. But I think that, you know, law enforcement needs to understand their communities that they're in. I mean, this started because of police killing young black men. And that's the issue at hand. It's why are they doing this? Why are they using extra force?
And
you know, the data shows that they don't use that kind of force with white men.
Anna, thank you very much. And Mark, in a way, that's, you know, people could argue that is the best way to affect some kind of specific change the most quickly. That if what really galvanized the current movement and outside attention on the current movement was the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and others in the last year, that's the immediate life or death question, for one thing, and that's the place that's most ripe for change. So go get that. And yes, also broaden out to the larger underlying inequalities that help to lead to those deaths. But go get that. That's where you have attention and opportunity right now. What do you think?
I'm not sure I would argue against that. I mean, I think that, yes, there are some very immediate things, some short-term issues that can be addressed, particularly in the area of policing. And again, I think you see a lot of activity around that in New York. But I don't think it's accurate to characterize the movement as saying this is where it started. No, this was a flashpoint. And so it was a way of dramatizing how America looks at black lives. And so you can't measure the value of a black life simply in relationship to a police officer and police officer engagement. You know, the reason why lives are devalued is because a whole series of practices and policies and ways in which black American lives are perceived, again, that reflect on our economic system, our health system, every aspect. And so when you talk about a life, you talk about something that is, a complex organism that, again, is not just, you cannot just talk in terms of how the police treat that person, but at the point that police officer is willing to shoot that person down, oftentimes what it seems like in cold blood, then there are a lot of other things that have led to that. There are reasons why they are perceived that way, and there are reasons why they believe that they can get away with that. And police reform is very important, but there are a whole series of changes and transformations that have to go on within American society that have to occur in order for that problem to really be addressed.
One more call. Caton in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Caton.
Hi. I've just noticed from Hillary Clinton, you know, there's a sort of Clintonian triangulation. It's kind of rich for her, for instance, to reference the gay rights movement as one of, you know, her reference points, because you know, she was very late in the game to support gay rights. And, you know, her husband's politics as far as, you know, law enforcement were some of the same things that exacerbated the problem of the black community. you know, deep cuts to public spending and public assistance, you know, heavy, heavy law enforcement, you know, mandatory minimums. And then, you know, on the other end, Defensive Marriage Act, you know, all signed during the Clinton years. And it's really rich for her to come back and say, oh, yeah, now we're supportive of the community. You know, I would just urge people not to be fooled, because it's almost, you know, it's transparently fake. I don't know how any other way to put it. I mean, if you're hoping to be, you know, a progressive, you know, someone who cares about these issues, I mean, she pretty much, you know, made herself clear by putting the onus back on the protesters when she is a policy maker. She's a policy driver. She should be, she should, mm-hmm. you know.
What she was trying to argue in the first of those clips, I think, was that, yeah, and she didn't quite just say it this directly, but yeah, there were some things, or she almost did, that yeah, there were some things that were enacted in the Bill Clinton administration years that have had terrible consequences for black lives, on criminal justice, on economic policy, on other things. And now I am trying to learn from the inadvertent ill effects of those things and come up with a different set of policies that are more ripe or right, more correct for now. Can you take that as possibly true?
I mean, I just don't see it. I mean, what has she specifically said was bad? You know, mandatory minimum that has, you know, criminalized a huge percentage of the black population and kept them incarcerated. And, you know, I mean, it seems, I mean, has she come out against those policies yet? I mean, not really. I think the perfect allegory for this is her support of gay marriage. You know, it took very long until most of the country was for it, and, you know, the president had come out for it, and the vice president had come out for it, then she decided to be for it. It seems just very disingenuous. By the way, Brian, I listen to your show all the time. Thank you very much for taking your call. This is my first call. Thank
Caitlin,
you very
call
much.
Us again. Don't make it your last. Thank you very much. So Mark Winston Griffith, to go out, I mean, as an activist or a journalist, I don't know that you want to get into critiques of specific candidates or their histories, but she's in a particular position with progressives who do see downsides of things that President Bill Clinton did during those years. How much can she move away from those? And I think on Black Lives Matter related issues and other things, this is an example of part of the conversation. Of course, there are so many aspects to the Hillary Clinton campaign and any presidential campaign, but one of the things that she'll have to do is reckon with progressives in various ways about things that, you know, trade is another one that they really didn't like and have come back to the fore as central issues on which she would have to take a different position than President Clinton had at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I think that what people want from Hillary Clinton is that they don't want to be finessed. And you know, Hillary Clinton and her husband Bill Clinton are very good at finessing. And, you know, what I think is very interesting is that actually Bill Clinton, when sort of confronted with the same question, actually did a much better job. I think he actually did almost a complete mea culpa and said, yes, you know, some of the policies that I helped enact actually did much more harm than good. And I think he was much more sort of human and transparent about that and just sort of straightforward. So I think that that is some of what people are going to be looking for. And I do agree that I think that the moment that you played the clip on was a more unguarded moment. I think that she still has some distance to go in terms mm-hmm. of being unguarded, particularly when you have someone like a Bernie Sanders in the race. The last thing I want to say is that when it comes to queer and transgender issues, It's interesting because she talked about hearts and minds, and we have seen exactly that people's hearts and minds changed around transgender and queer people and started seeing them more as people, and that's when you began to see policy changes. Hmm. And when it relates to the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, when you talk to a lot of people, they're saying, look, we're not just talking about, we're talking about all black lives. We're talking about not just men. We're talking about women. We're talking about queer and transgender people. And those lives have not been particularly valued as well. So that kind of intersectionality is also playing into the Black Lives Matter movement.
Mark Winston Griffith, journalist with the Nation Institute and executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center based in Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, there you have extended excerpts from the Hillary Clinton with Black Lives Matter activists, kind of spontaneous meeting in New Hampshire last week, and some discussion around it. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will meet the director of New York City's Human Rights Commission. Stay with us.